Hello, and welcome to the Phantasms of the Living podcast. I'm your host, the paranormal author and musician, Simon Thought, coming to you from New England, USA. I apologize for the very long delay between the last episode of this podcast and this one, but life gets in the way of death sometimes. I hope you understand, and I'll humbly ask for your forgiveness. As it's been a while, allow me to set the table again with a little background. This series covers case studies from the seminal two-volume massive work known as Phantasms of the Living, published in 1886 by the Society for Psychical Research in England. The Society was made up of both skeptics and believers in the paranormal and conducted research into various areas in an attempt to prove whether such phenomena were real or not. In the parlance of the Society, a phantasm was their term for a paranormal event. In the book, the authors explored about 700 case studies of such events, ranging from sightings of ghosts, premonitions of future events, telepathy, and more. They and their team from the Society then performed research to determine whether there was any truth to the story being told and whether they were corroborated by real events. This podcast will read those case studies and the results of the Society's research into them, then discuss them. As I mentioned in the last episode, oh so long ago, the book entitled Phantasms of the Dead came into my possession in two forms. I found an original second edition, which is called Phantasms of the Dead, or True Ghost Stories, by Hereward Carrington, which was published in 1920. Yes, I said Hereward, as in H-E-R-E-W-A-R-D, and not Howard. Hereward Carrington was a British-born American who lived from 1880 until 1956. I then found an original first edition of that same book called simply True Ghost Stories from 1915. Inside the front cover, someone wrote the inscription Lefebvre Dubois, 1921, in pen. I did not find out anything about this person, but I assume it was someone who once owned the book. So as it turns out, Mr. Carrington was a member of the Society for Psychical Research both in England and America and worked on investigations for them as a researcher. He was very critical of paranormal claims and was able to debunk certain mediums as frauds. This led to friction with some of the Society's members who did not at all like his debunking activities, which included Sherlock Holmes author Arthur Conan Doyle. Carrington then went out on his own, conducting many paranormal investigations around the United States and writing numerous books, with one of his most famous being the book originally entitled True Ghost Stories, and then later retitled Phantasms of the Dead, or True Ghost Stories, in the subsequent editions. I assume the title change was to subliminally link it to the massive Phantasms of the Living volumes which had come out earlier. This approachable style made his books popular. He founded the American Psychical Institute, which ran a laboratory to research paranormal claims. I find Mr. Carrington's writing style to be more approachable and less sciencey than the Phantasms of the Living. It seems like he was looking to make the Phantasms of the Living's approach to investigating paranormal events, but making it more commercial to the casual reader. Of course, True Ghost Stories came out about 30 years after Phantasms of the Living, and writing styles had changed, even renaming what had been called Phantasms as Ghosts, which is the term still used today. His scientific approach took a bit of a hit due to his advocacy of odd diets and food fads, such as not eating breakfast, fasting, and eating only raw food. He also did not believe in germs. His writings on these subjects were heavily criticized by scientists. While Carrington's food theories would make an interesting podcast all on its own, we are not going to go down that rabbit hole. What we are going to do in this episode, however, is take a break from Phantasms of the Living's case studies so we can delve into Carrington's Phantasms of the Dead. This episode is going to discuss two of Mr. Carrington's investigations of haunted houses, the first of which is called The Record of a Haunted House. When phantasms of the dead constantly appear in one house, and there only, that house is said to be haunted. And in such a case, the phantasms seem to be attracted to the locality more than to the individuals living in it. This is usually the case in so-called haunted houses. No matter who lives in them, they one and all see the same spectral forms, but this is not invariably so. In the case of the Great Amherst Mystery, for example, given below, The hauntings seem to be associated with the person more than the house, so that we might be said to hear a case of a haunted man or woman. But this is the exception, not the rule. The cases that follow are all well attested, and the phenomena have been witnessed by many persons. The original reports, for the most part, have appeared in the proceedings of the SPR, and the facts were carefully investigated at the time by competent investigators. The first instance is particularly interesting because of the experiments which were tried to ascertain the nature of the ghost. And if many more such experiments were conducted, we might hope in time to know something about them. I shall begin with a carefully recorded example, which I may call the record of a haunted house. The case of a haunted house here given is very well authenticated and corroborated by 6 written and signed statements, as well as that of the original informant. The account originally appeared in the Proceedings of the SPR, Volume 8, pages 311 through 32, and is drawn up by Miss Morton, a lady of scientific training who resided for a long time in the house in question. She was well known to Mr. Myers, then Honorable Secretary of the Society. Very interesting experiments were conducted to test the nature of the ghost, as the following brief account will show. My father took the house in March 1882, none of us having then heard of anything unusual about the house. We moved in towards the end of April. It was not until the following June that I first saw the apparition. I'd gone up to my room and was not yet in bed when I heard someone at the door and went to it, thinking it might be my mother. On opening the door, I saw no one. But on going a few steps down the passage, I saw the figure of a tall lady, dressed in black, standing at the head of the stairs. After a few moments, she descended the stairs, and I followed her for a short distance, feeling curious what it could be. I had only a small piece of candle, and it suddenly burnt itself out, and being unable to see more, I went back to my room. On the night of August 2nd, the footsteps were heard by my 3 sisters and by the cook, all of whom slept on the top landing, also by my married sister, Mrs. K., who was sleeping on the floor below. They all said the next morning that they had heard them very plainly pass and repass their doors. These footsteps are very characteristic and are not at all like those of any people in the house. They are soft and rather slow, though decided and even. My sisters would not go out on the landing after hearing them pass, but each time when I've gone out after hearing them, I've seen the figure there. On the evening of August 1st, we were sitting in the drawing room with the gas lit, but the shutters not shut, the light outside getting dusk, my brothers and a friend having just given up tennis, finding it too dark, my elder sister, Mrs. E., and myself both saw the figure on the balcony outside looking in at the window. She stood there some minutes, then walked to the end and back again, after which she seemed to disappear. She soon after came into the drawing room when I saw her, but my sister did not. The apparitions were always of exactly the same type, seen in the same places, by the same people, at varying intervals. The footsteps continued and were heard by several visitors and new servants who had taken the places in the house of those who had left, as well as by myself, 4 sisters and brothers, in all by about 20 people, many of them not having previously heard of the apparitions and sounds. Other sounds were also heard in addition, which seemed gradually to increase in intensity. They consisted in walking up and down on the second floor landing, of bumps against the doors of the bedrooms, and of the handles of the doors turning. The bumps against the doors were so marked as to terrify a new servant, who had heard nothing of the haunting, into the belief that burglars were breaking into her room. During the year, at Mr. Myers' suggestion, I kept a photographic camera constantly ready to try to photograph the figure, but on the few occasions I was able to do so, I got no result. At night, usually only by candlelight, a long exposure would be necessary for so dark a figure, and this I could not obtain. I also tried to communicate with the figure, constantly speaking to it and asking it to make signs if not able to speak, but with no result. I also tried especially to touch her, but did not succeed. On cornering her, as I once did, she vanished. One night, my sister E. went up to her room on the second story, but as she passed the room where my 2 sisters L and M were sleeping, they opened their door to say that they had heard noises,
and also seen what they described as the flame of a candle without candle or handle visible cross the room diagonally from corner to corner. Two of the maids opened the doors to their bedrooms and said that they also heard noises. They all five stood at their doors with their lighted candles for some time. They all heard steps walking up and down the landing between them. As they passed, they felt a sensation which they described as a cold wind through their candles, though were not blown out. They saw nothing. The steps then descended the stairs, reascended, again descended, and did not return. The figure became much less substantial in its later appearances. Up to about 1886, it was so solid and lifelike that it was often mistaken for a real person. It gradually became less distinct. At all times, it intercepted the light. We have not been able to ascertain if it cast a shadow. I should mention that it has been seen through window glass and that I myself wear glasses habitually, though none of the other percipients do so. The upper part of the figure always left a more distinct impression than the lower, but this may partly be due to the fact that one naturally looks at people's faces before their feet. For proofs of immateriality, one, I have several times fastened fine strings across the stairs at various heights before going to bed, but after all others have gone up to their rooms. I have twice at least seen the figure pass through the cords, leaving them intact. Two, the sudden and complete disappearance of the figure while still in full view. Three, the impossibility of touching the figure. Four, it has appeared in a room with the doors shut. We have strong grounds for believing that the apparition was seen by two dogs. Twice I remember seeing our dog suddenly run up to the mat at the foot of the stairs in the hall, wagging his tail and moving his back in the way dogs do when expecting to be caressed. It jumped up, fawning as it would do so if a person was standing there, but suddenly slink away with its tail between its legs and retreated, trembling, under a sofa. We were all strongly under the impression that it had seen the figure. Its action was peculiar and was much more striking to an onlooker than it could possibly appear from a description. In conclusion, as to the feelings aroused by the presence of the figure, it is very difficult to describe them. On the first few occasions, I think the feeling of awe at something unknown, mixed with a strong desire to know more about it, predominated. Later, when I was able to analyze my feelings more closely, and the first novelty had gone off, I was conscious of a feeling of loss, as if I'd lost power to the figure. Most of the other percipients speak of a feeling of cold wind, but I myself have not experienced this. You can see Carrington's interest in approaching paranormal claims scientifically, which lends credence to the times when he cannot debunk those claims. Carrington's distinction between whether the house is haunted or the person in the house is haunted is interesting, particularly since his research into numerous haunted houses led him to believe that the haunting of the person is, as he said, the exception and not the rule. This would seem to indicate that spirits prefer to inhabit places, and that, by entering or disturbing such spaces, we can stir those spirits up and cause them to act out, if you will.
It really is easy to start your own podcast. It's an inexpensive and fun way to expand your reach and provide opinions and interests to others. Buzzsprout is the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message out to the world. Following the link in this show's notes lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and helps support our show. We use Buzzsprout, and I can say it took no time at all to get this podcast out to you. I could not have done it without Buzzsprout's help. Podcasting isn't hard. You just have to know who to work with. Get out there and get talking now.
The next investigation is called Bee House, which seems to be named to avoid outing the exact location. This is a very famous case of haunting, which was investigated by Sir Oliver Lodge, Mr. F.W.H. Myers, Colonel Taylor, a specialist on haunted houses, Miss X, the Marquis of Bute, etc. The chief reports of this occurrence are due to the last three named persons and from the journal kept during their occupancy of the house, the following extracts are made. February 4th, Thursday. I woke suddenly just before 3 a.m. Miss Moore, who had been lying awake for over 2 hours, said, "I want you to stay awake and listen." Almost immediately, I was startled by a loud clanging sound, which seemed to resound throughout the house. The mental image it brought to my mind was of a long metal bar, such as I've seen near iron foundries, being struck at intervals with a wooden mallet. The noise was distinctly that of metal struck with wood. It seemed to come diagonally across the house. It sounded very loud, though distinct, and the idea that any inmate of the house should not hear it seemed preposterous. I also had an experience this morning, which may have been purely subjective, but which should be recorded. About 10 a.m., I was writing in the library, face to light, back to fire. Mrs. W. was in the room and addressed me once or twice, but I was aware of not being responsive as I was much occupied. I wrote on and presently felt a distinct but gentle push against my chair. I thought it was the dog and looked down, but he was not there. I went on writing and in a few minutes felt a push, firm and decided, against myself, which moved me on my chair. I thought it was Mrs. W., who, having spoken and obtained no answer, was reminding me of her presence. I looked backward with an exclamation. The room was empty. She came in presently and called my attention to the dog, who was gazing intently from the hearth rug at the place where I had expected before to see him. As the day began with the above, and I had a quiet rest, I went to the copse at dusk. The moon was bright and the twilight lingered. We waited about in the avenue to let it get darker, but it was still far from dark. Then we made our way up to the glen, Miss Moore, Miss Langton, and myself. I saw Ishbel and Margot in the old spot across the burn, two spirits who had before been seen at the house several times. Ishbel was on her knees in the attitude of weeping. Margot, apparently reasoning with her in a low voice, to which Ishbel replied very occasionally. I could not hear what was said from the noise of the burn. We waited for perhaps 10 or 15 minutes. They had appeared when I had been there for 3 or 4. When we regained the avenue in silence, Miss Moore asked Miss Langton, "What did you see?" She had been told nothing except that the colonel, who did not know details then, had said in her presence something about a couple of nuns. She said, "I saw nothing, but I heard a low talking." Questioned further, she said it seemed close behind. The glen is so narrow that this might be quite consistent with what I heard and saw. Miss Moore heard a murmuring voice and is quite certain that it was not the burn. She's less suggestible than almost anyone I know. The dog ran up while we were there, pointed, and ran straight for the two women. He afterwards left us, and we found him barking in the glen. He's a dog who hardly ever barks. We went up among the trees where he was and could find no cause. This morning's phenomenon is the most incomprehensible I have yet known. I heard the banging sounds after we were in bed last night. Early this morning, about 5:30, I was awakened by them. They continued for nearly an hour. Then another sound began in the room. It might have been made by a very lively kitten jumping and pouncing, or even by a very large bird. There was a fluttering noise, too. In the footnote, this fluttering noise, as of a bird, is very often met with in the literature of the occult and is typical of haunted houses. In the famous case of Lord Lyttelton, for instance, this was recorded and was said to announce his death. He died 3 days later in bed. It was close, exactly opposite the bed. Miss Moore woke up, and we heard the noise going on till nearly 8 o'clock. I drew up the blinds and opened the windows wide. I saw all over the room, looking into cupboards and under furniture. We cannot guess at any possible explanation. A few weeks later, Miss X wrote in her journal, "The general tone of things is disquieting and new in our experience. Hitherto, in our first occupation, the phenomena affected me as melancholy, depressing, and perplexing. But now all, quite independently, say the same thing, that the influence is evil and horrible. Even poor little Spooks the dog, who never terrified before, has been since our return here. The worn faces at breakfast are really a dismal sight. Soon after this, the investigators left the house. I love that the dog is named Spook. If you want to hear more from Phantasms of the Dead, let me know. I'd be happy to return to Mr. Carrington's work in future installments. We now come to the end of another episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. I am Simon Thought, and I wrote and produced it, other than the parts read from Phantasms of the Dead itself, of course. Our theme song is called The Salad Bar and was performed by my band, Simon Thought and the Uploads. It's available on the usual music streaming platforms if you are so inclined. Any comments from listeners about what you think these case studies mean would be appreciated. You can also tell me your story of phantasms you've experienced, and I may read what you send me in a future episode. You never know. I can be reached by email at simonthoughtintheuploads@gmail.com. I will review and discuss further case studies from phantasms of the living or dead in future episodes, and I hope you will join me. Thank you for listening, and be vigilant. You never know when a phantasm will occur, so keep an eye out. Be well, and goodbye.